So I'm Rainer Lavenbacher, and I'm a professor at the University of Florida in the Department of Medicine, the Division of Pulmonary Critical Care and Sleep Medicine.
Wonderful. You were actually very close to me at some point. So when I was still working at the University of South Florida, I was your neighbor to the south, I guess. My name is Panvi Bahia. I'm a neuroscientist, communicator, and your host for Biology in Numbers, a podcast by the Society for Mathematical Biology. Reinhard, how are you today?
Good, thank you. How about you?
I'm very well. Thank you so much. So the first thing I'm going to ask you is to get you to tell me where your allegiances lie. So are you team math or are you team bio?
Well, so I was trained as a mathematician, and for many years I worked as a theoretical mathematician, proving theorems about things that really had nothing to do with the real world. And then at some point I switched to applied mathematics, mathematical biology. I started out at Virginia Tech University in the Department of Mathematics. I was a tenured professor in mathematics and a professor at the Virginia Bioinformatics Institute. That was back in 2000 when bioinformatics was the shiny new hot thing and not a commodity like it is today. And from there, I moved to the University of Connecticut into the College of Medicine. I established the Center for Quantitative Medicine there. And 4 years ago, I moved down here to the University of Florida.
Wonderful. Do you think that the theoretical mathematicians felt betrayed by your switch to more applied stuff?
Yeah, so I should, I haven't answered your question yet. So my training is clearly on the mathematical side, but as you can tell from my affiliations, I now sit squarely in a clinical environment. I work very closely with clinicians, with experimentalists. And so I would say I have one foot very firmly in each one of those two camps. And in fact, we have colleagues here who are mathematicians and run experimental programs and do their own experiments. And they are sort of one step further in unifying those two components of this field.
That's wonderful. So before we delve deeper into your work specifically, do you think you can describe your research in 60 seconds or less?
So we work on identifying mechanisms of disease and the underlying mechanisms that the human body uses to respond to these diseases. And we use mathematical modeling and simulation to identify interventions, therapeutics, so translational medicine.
That was very succinct. Excellent. Moving on to our podcast benefactors, can you tell us what the Society for Mathematical Biology means to you as a researcher in the field?
Yeah, so I think ever since the beginning of scientific societies, like in the 17th century, you know, the Académie des Sciences in France and the Royal Society in England, scientific societies had sort of two main purposes. They were involved in dissemination of science through publication primarily, and to create an environment in which scientists could come together and exchange ideas, exchange information. And I think that's been an important role until now. I think in the present time, I would add two more roles for scientific societies. One is to develop the workforce in the future. That's become very important. And another one is to advocate for their community, to advocate for whatever particular focus that society has. You know, science is very money dependent. If you don't have funds, you can't do science, you don't get promoted, you don't get tenure. So it's very important to have an advocate. And, you know, as they say, if you're not at the table, you're likely on the table. So societies help us to be at the table. You know, and I mean, a great example is AAAS, right, that really does extremely well in all four of those. And to me, that's what a society like SMB should be doing. That's what I'm looking toward. And SMB does that to some extent. There is the Bulletin of Mathematical Biology that is one of the very well recognized journals in that field. I was editor in chief for 6 years for the journal. And there's the annual meeting, which is well attended. There were, I think, 1,100 attendees maybe at the meeting in South Korea just now. And I think the society has made some strides in building a workforce. We have a mentoring committee. We have a DEI committee. And I think, you know, advocacy, maybe we're a little bit too small at this point, but hopefully that's something that we can develop further. So that's what I'm looking for in SMB. And as a president, that's what I would hope to do, is strengthen sort of all four of these aspects. And of course, one of the things at the end of the day that's needed for all four of those is income. Yeah, societies need income from various sources to do this sort of thing, right? Most societies get a big chunk of their income from publications. The same is true for SMB. There is donations, there's membership fees. And so one of the things I hope to do as a president is look to enhance our income in different ways.
Yeah, so you essentially answered my next question, which was, what are your goals and what would you like to achieve during your tenureship as the next president? But out of curiosity, where do you think you could get those funds from? Because as I understand it, more and more societies are leaning towards open access journals, which is excellent because we should have that information freely available. But at the same time, obviously, that means that societies or, you know, any organization cannot charge as much or get as much income from that as a source.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, publishing is sort of a bit the Wild West in the meantime. And I think everybody, including publishers, is sort of grasping at solutions, right? And the different modes of income for publishers change, for example, to make open access more palatable to scientists. There are now agreements with universities so that universities, rather than paying subscriptions to journals, they essentially pay open access fees for all their faculty. That's one possible way. For SMB, of course, that has been discussed quite a bit, open access publishing. And of course, one of the valid arguments is that the membership of SMB, a lot of people are not in a situation to have large NIH grants or other research grants that they could use to pay $2,500 or $3,000 open access fee for a journal. And so one thing we definitely don't want to do is price a lot of our members out of publishing in our journal.
Right? Yeah.
So there's a number of things that one can do and that we will discuss with Springer Nature, our publishing partner, that I think we've had a really good relationship with. And they are as interested as we are in making our journals successful. Of course, one of the things when you look, SMB is an extremely cheap society to join. Our membership fees are, you know, very, very small. And I think the more we can adjust those to realities, the more services we can offer members, the more travel fellowships we can offer, the more subsidies for conferences and so on. So that'll be an ongoing discussion within the board and with the membership, is how can we enhance our revenue. Of course, donations is an obvious place that we could look for. So we don't have any sort of an organized fundraising effort, which other societies have. We don't have extensive sponsorship of conferences by companies and other potentially interested parties. So all of those things I would like to explore, and I know everybody else on the board is very interested in that as well.
That makes a lot of sense. So going back to AAAS, or as the full name is known, is the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and that's a well-established and prestigious society involved in, as you said, everything from education to science communication to policy. You happen to be a fellow of the society. Can you tell us more about what it means to be a fellow?
I'm a fellow of the society. I served the last 2 years as chair of the mathematics section. So AAAS is organized in 24 sections for the different disciplines and the mathematics section. Before that, I served for 4 years as the secretary. So I have a pretty good sense of what the society does, how it operates, and what its fellows program does. And the way fellows are selected there is the different steering groups, like the steering group for mathematics, have each section, depending on its size, has allotted a certain number of fellows each year that the group selects in collaboration with the membership. And then the community, of course, can nominate people to become fellows. For one, it's a little bit like, you know, with every other society, essentially you want to recognize what you consider as being the members that have been particularly involved in the society, that have made scientific accomplishments, and they can serve in some way as representatives of the society and the membership. And I think for AAAS in particular, it works that way. You talk to a dean at a university or a provost or a president, they know all about what AAAS means, and institutions want to increase their number of AAAS fellows. It means something in terms of the scientific quality of the fellows. So, it does that to you, right? When you become a fellow, you do feel a certain responsibility that now you're a bit more of an official representative.
Well, very good. So we've talked a fair bit about your involvement with math, biology, and societies. So let's get back to your work specifically. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us how you ended up in the field of mathematical biology? Was there kind of a defining thing that made you switch from the theoretical to the more applied?
Well, it was a long and highly nonlinear path that I took. What happened is at some point, so I was a theoretical mathematician, and at some point I got interested in the history of mathematics. And the defining event was really a colleague of mine and I, at the time I was a professor in the mathematics department at New Mexico State University. And we were teaching one of these courses that everybody hates is math for liberal arts majors, right? So you teach math to English majors and business majors, and it's frustrating to teach it because, like, if you're a chemist, you can show all sorts of fancy things and blue liquid turning into clear liquid and things like that. But for math, you can't really. We like to tell people what research is about, but it doesn't work. And so the idea we had is, rather than bring our students close to modern day research, we would simply take the students and move them back in history until their mathematical knowledge coincides with the cutting edge knowledge in mathematics at the time. And so for some, that'll be the 19th century, for some, it'll be the Renaissance, for some, it'll be Babylonian mathematics, but everybody has a place.
That's very cool.
Yeah, so we put together some material, some books. We ended up doing some actual research in the history of mathematics. And, you know, when you do that, you think about, you know, why do famous mathematicians do what they do, and what impact did they have? And I started to think about my own work in those terms. And that sort of led to what you might call maybe an academic midlife crisis, so to speak. And it led me to shift, and through a series of coincidences, basically, I ended up at the Virginia Bioinformatics Institute, and I ended up being a professor of computational biology. And that's how that worked. And then I started to work in iron metabolism and cancer, and I ran into sort of somebody who was studying iron metabolism in terms of the immune response to pathogens. And then through another long series of coincidences, I ended up with a pulmonary immunologist as a collaborator who was at the University of Virginia at the time. And then I moved on to the University of Connecticut, and he moved on to the University of Florida. He's the division chief for pulmonary medicine here. And then at some point we had a grant together, and I was visiting your former colleagues at the Moffitt Cancer Center at some point. Mm-hmm. And I thought I'd make the trip up the road to visit my collaborator here. And that's when we discussed about my possibly moving here. And that's how I ended up in this whole sort of translational biomedicine kind of research. So it was sort of, in some sense, a whole string of coincidences. But it's if you look at it sort of in the context of my entire career, it started from doing mathematics as an abstract art to, you know, translational medicine.
Wonderful. And so I know, obviously, at Moffitt, they have a very unique setup where the researchers within the integrated math oncology department work directly with physicians and scientists. Do you get to do the same?
Yeah. So in fact, so we have by now, our group is about 15 people, mostly mathematicians, some computer scientists, some engineers. And we're literally co-located with labs. I have people in white coats down the hall. And so, yes, it's very integrated. In fact, my collaborator and I, our labs are really integrated, that some of my people do experiments in his lab. We have joint lab meetings. It's very much, and it makes a huge difference.
Yeah. So I hear from them. I mean, to try and do a research project and kind of expect that the biological data comes in and dribs and drabs is not going to help develop an idea very well.
Yeah, so and certainly Moffitt has been you know, one of the pioneers in this with Sandy Anderson and Bob Gatenby.
Yeah, so that leads us very well into my next question, which is, can you talk about your research specifically or highlight a particular project that you're interested in or working on currently?
Well, so when we started out maybe 10 years ago with Borna Merad, my immunology collaborator, he had been working on the immune response to fungal infections in the lung. In particular, a fungus, Aspergillus fumigatus, which is quite harmless, it's everywhere. But if you're immunocompromised, it's quite deadly. So if you're undergoing chemotherapy, then you're at real risk of a very serious infection. And so a long-term goal was to find ways to develop host-centric therapeutics rather than just pathogen-centric therapeutics. So the way people are typically treated is antifungals. There are quite good new generations of antifungals available, but the mortality rate for immunocompromised patients that get invasive aspergillosis is still on the order of 50-60%. So it's very, very high. And our idea was to build a multi-scale computational model of the immune response in the lungs, or the immune system. You have the fungus. And one of the key features of battling this infection is what you could call the battle over iron. So pathogens like fungi or bacteria, they need iron to replicate. And they have very sophisticated systems to scavenge iron from the host. And the host, as part of the innate immune system, has very sophisticated systems to fight that. And a key feature of that system, namely a certain type of white blood cells called neutrophils, they are missing if you're immunocompromised, say you are in chemotherapy. And so we were looking at things like, you know, what could we do to maybe enhance other parts of the immune system to make up for this lack of neutrophils? And we've made a lot of progress, and we're now close to having figured out what one of those mechanisms could be. It's essentially a way to slow down or temporarily prevent hemorrhaging in the lungs that you get when the fungus grows through the interstitial space into the circulatory system that surrounds the alveoli. So that's where we are in a nutshell. And where we went from there is, in the last few years, we've focused a lot on this, in medicine, relatively novel concept of a digital twin. So these are basically computational models that are personalized to a particular patient and that allow you to customize a treatment to a patient. So what we're focusing in particular on is, can we use such models to customize treatment of patients who are in the intensive care unit with pneumonia, whether it's fungal, bacterial, or viral pneumonia? That's what we're doing this now.
Very cool. The digital twin sounds like an excellent replacement for the kind of things that you see in dystopian sci-fi movies, you know, where they have just like rich people have clones that are replacements of them that they can just like harvest organs and things from. Yeah. So can you tell us a little bit more about how a digital twin works?
Well, so the concept comes from industry. So the idea is you build an engine of some sort. That's typically built using a mathematical specification. So you have essentially a model of that engine. And as the engine operates, you can today with the Internet of Things, you can pull data off of that engine as it, you know, motors around the country. And you can feed those data into the mathematical model, and you can customize this model and have the model evolve as the engine evolves. Like different parts of the engine might, you know, experience different kinds of wear, excessive wear maybe, and your model picks that up. And so you can, for example, use your model for preventive maintenance. So you tell, you know, whatever railroad company operates your engine to say, the next time you perform maintenance on this engine, replace this part. Otherwise it'll break down somewhere in between. So I was at a rollout of some data platform for a digital twin data platform for a big company, and their customer-facing motto was no unscheduled downtime. And of course, yeah, there's sort of the obvious extension for patients, no unscheduled doctor visits. if that's not a dystopian vision.
Yes, indeed.
So So as an example, one of the things that I think is essentially such a digital twin is the artificial pancreas. And there are a couple of devices like that on the market. So that's a mathematical model of glucose metabolism that a patient essentially carries around on a smartphone-like device. And so this is for type 1 diabetics, I should say. So yeah. Type 1 diabetics don't produce insulin. And so you need to inject insulin. And typically people measure their glucose levels several times during the day and then inject certain amounts of insulin. And what this device does is it uses a subcutaneous sensor to sense glucose levels, feeds them into this model. The model uses a closed loop controller to calculate the amount of insulin that you need and then drives an insulin pump that's strapped to your waist or your calf or some appropriate place, and it automatically injects insulin.
That's amazing.
So there's an example.
Very cool. In fact, I want to say I met somebody at the meeting who had one of those. We were all very impressed by it. So for the math bio nerds, can you tell us more about the kinds of models that you use?
Yeah, so we for our lung model, we look at a multi-scale model that's at the tissue level. It's essentially an agent-based model with different spatial features. So you can represent physically alveoli, you could represent the circulation, you can represent cells moving around. And one reason for choosing this particular modeling paradigm is that the way this infection generally starts is through a small number of spores. So you might inhale one or two or three or five of these spores, and they lodge in your lower respiratory tree. And if you don't happen to have a resident macrophage in one of those alveoli, then you might overlook this particular spore, and it might germinate, and it might ultimately lead to an infection. So it's a very patchy kind of initial pathogenesis, which it's difficult to model using differential equations. Now, each of the cells that we look at, immune cells, epithelial cells, they have intracellular networks with them, which in our case we represent as Boolean networks. You have different molecules that diffuse cytokines, nutrients like iron. They're represented through partial differential equations that control diffusion. The liver is involved in producing hormones that get transported to the lungs, and so there are transport equations. So it's kind of a hodgepodge of different models that work at different scales. And that causes in itself, that causes interesting sort of computational issues. How do you stitch all these different scales together? How do you make sure that all that works? And of course, we want to build all of this in a way so that you can expand it. So we're working now on expanding this to viral pathogens. So we have a project where we use SARS-CoV-2, the Omicron variant, to do the same thing for viruses. And also we want to do it for bacteria. For bacteria, it's the whole modeling issue is sort of different because the bacteria in your lung, they grow incredibly quickly. And in no time, your whole lung is filled with bacteria. So at that point, representing individual bacteria in an agent-based model makes no more sense. So it's very interesting from both a biological and a technological point of view. And we have some interesting experimental systems. We have a 3D ex vivo cell culture system, which we get lung tissue from surgeries that happen here in the hospital. It's a really interesting setup.
Sounds very cool. And it also sounds like it probably keeps you very busy.
Yeah, which is good.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's essentially all the questions I have for you today, other than a little segment at the end where we like to have you answer some quick fire questions for us so people can get to know Reinhard, the person behind the science. Mm. And so my first one is, I really love that you sent us a picture of you wearing your biker leathers as your profile picture. So for people who actually understand such things, what kind of motorbike do you ride?
So I've actually two motorcycles. My father used to race motorcycles. So I've been around motorcycles ever since I was a kid. So I've done this all my life. And for the longest time, all I had was a motorcycle. I didn't have any cars. So one motorcycle I have is a 1400 Kawasaki Ninja. So that's the fastest production motorcycle you can buy at the moment. So it's sort of like a modified racing bike, if you like, which is incredibly much fun. It's not very comfortable, but It's very fun. And the other one is it's a BMW. It's a 1250 GS Adventure. And as you might guess, as the name says, it's built for adventure touring. So you can ride it on the road and you can ride it off the road. And you can go a long ways. So early this year, my wife and I rode it around in Patagonia.
Oh, wow. That sounds amazing.
Yeah.
I think the other thing I really enjoy about this is that this is very much outside the stereotype of what a mathematician is like, right? You don't expect them to ride motorcycles.
Yeah, yeah, I could tell you a few other ones. But
maybe another time.
Maybe another time.
So my second question is, what day in your life would you like to relive?
Yeah, I love that question. It's a complicated one. I've been very lucky. I've lived a long life and I've lived a really good life. So I have lots of days I would like to relive. But if I were to pick a particular one, I would say there are days that involve my mother. So my mother was the most influential and important person in my life. And when I went to the United States, when I was 22, I came as a Fulbright exchange student, not knowing that I would never return to Germany to live permanently there. I've lived in the US ever since. It was very hard for her and it was very hard for me. But then, you know, many years later, my wife and I used to visit her, like in the summers, and we'd go for drives. We'd go for a day to Salzburg or to visit one of the castles that the Bavarian King Ludwig built. And we'd stop at cafes for a Kaffee und Kuchen, some, you know, coffee and cake, obligatory in Germany.
Yeah,
those were great days. I'd take any one of those.
Very nice. And the final one I have for you is, what's a skill that you've always wanted to learn but haven't yet?
I want to play the harmonica.
Oh, interesting. Why the harmonica?
Well, it's a fascinating instrument. It's been used in, you know, blues, country, classical music, all over the place. You know, if you've seen The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, probably the most memorable thing is the harmonica at the end. And it's very small. You can put it in your pocket. You can take it anywhere. And so I envision, you know, in my retirement at some point, I can sit in some log cabin in the mountains and have a dog and a cup of coffee and play the harmonica.
Very nice. Well, thank you once again for your time, Reinhard. I very much enjoyed our conversation today.
Thanks so much, Phoebe. I really appreciate it.
Listening to Biology and Numbers, a podcast from the Society for Mathematical Biology and produced by me, Pavi Bahia, at Earth Science Media. A reminder that if you're doing cool stuff within the field of math biology and you'd like a chance to be featured, email Jane Heffernan at president@smb.org. Make sure that you go ahead and pitch your research project, your involvement with SMB, and why you think you should be featured, and we'll look forward to picking some new stars for the pod. As always, you can learn more about SMB on the website smb.org and via social media on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Find the links to all of these and some for today's guest in the episode show notes. Finally, don't forget to subscribe via your favorite platform, and if you like the show, give us some love by reviewing. I may well be in Edmonton too. So we'll try and make the effort to go to the...
I will certainly be in Edmonton. I'll ride my motorcycle up there.
Oh, that's so cool. So let me end the recording.